Grateful that you've invited me to come. I've known Zeke for a number of years now and always appreciated him and always enjoyed his and Cheryl's company when we could be together. Zeke and I have roughly the same kind of a sense of humor. We laugh at the same things. We think the same things are funny. I didn't realize this, but apparently I cause a disturbance in the household every now and then because I'll think of something funny and I'll send it to Zeke. And Cheryl told me that she'll see him giggling and said, "What did David say today?" And he does the same for me. My wife always knows when I get a Zekogram because I'll be sitting on the couch giggling and she'll wonder what the funny is about. But I enjoy his company, but I'm more than just his humor. I really appreciate his spiritual mindedness and his understanding of the scriptures, and periodically we'll bounce things off of each other, and he'll call and say, "I need to pick your brain about something." And I assure them that I'll take about 30 seconds, and then that's about all you're going to get. He has a lot deeper well than I have, but I gain a lot from our friendship and enjoy the time that we spend together. And I've looked forward to coming here and being with you for a long time. Now, we're going to be talking today about the book of Exodus. And Zeke told me that this is kind of broad. He sent me a lot of different scriptures that he thought we could use in the lesson. And I looked them all over and started with the Ten Commandments. And just in a few minutes, we're going to read through the Ten Commandments in the book of Exodus chapter 20. So if you want to go ahead and turn there, that's where we will begin in just a second. But when I looked over all the passages that he sent to me, it occurred to me that we have an opportunity this morning to not only address the great Old Testament story of the book of Exodus, but to really glean some information that would be helpful to us living in our current age. He had mentioned to me that he wanted me to send a title for the lesson. After looking all these things over, I said, "You know, I think, Zeke, I want to title the lesson, The Awful Power of Culture." Think about the word culture for just a minute and what it implies. The word culture has to do with the time and the events during which one lives and how that affects you. Culture is just sort of the setting in which we all abide. We live in a time when things are good, but a lot of things are bad. We probably all think about the bad more than we should, to be honest with you. We think about the elections that came and went in the past few years, and whoever is elected, there's always a divide on either side of the issue. Some were for one fella, some were for another. Nobody ever really gets what they wanted in the president. There's always half that like one guy, half that hated him. And after the year or two has passed, most everybody dislikes the president, whoever it is. We look at the circumstances of our day and we realize those things are true. There's not much we can do about it. I'm guaranteed one vote in my nation. And if we're not careful, we can get pretty down about what we see going on. But what I've tried to always remember is that I serve a king more than I serve a president or a congress or anything else. And I've tried to keep that in perspective, that Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And that certainly helps me an awful lot to cope with the difficulties we see. But I also have to face realistically the things that go on in Washington may or may not affect me too directly. But what happens in West Columbia does. What's going on in your town affects you. What's happening right around your neighborhood does wear off on you on some level. The people who are your friends, the people that your companions are, these people will most definitely shape you in some way or other. So when we get caught up in who's elected and who's not, it's going to be a wash generally one way or the other as the elections all play out. But what happens in your community, what happens with your circle of friends, and what happens in your children's schools, all of this can weigh heavily on what kind of people we are. And what we find from the Bible is that we are required by God to resist the culture we're in, to resist a culture that turns our hearts away from God. Take a look with me. Hold your place here at Exodus chapter 20 and go over to the book of 1 John chapter 2. And let's just notice what John had to say about it. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15. John says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. Now, one other thing that he says, the world is passing away and the lust of it, but he who does the will of the Father abides forever. Now, this little brief statement about the world, I believe, perfectly summarizes the danger and the threat of culture. The New Testament calls the devil the god of this age. And we're told in the New Testament that the devil is like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. We are to resist him steadfast in the faith. But nevertheless, he's like a roaring lion. If the devil is the god of this age and the world is to be resisted, then that's where our real concern should lie. We should resist any and all efforts to turn our hearts away from God. We ought to be aware of the temptations that await us every day. We ought to be concerned enough to purposely look at what is good and wholesome and righteous. One of the reasons why we have these gospel meetings, it's more than just a way for the church to use some of its funds that have been collected. That's just some minor little thing that exists, the treasury. What matters is we have a group of people who are worshiping and working together who are trying to fight against that same enemy and trying to go to heaven when we die. So the more opportunities we have to study what's in this book and to grow by the knowledge of it, the better we're going to be, because that world is always there rubbing up against us, always trying its best to lead us down the pathway of unrighteousness. I want to throw out a for instance before we go any further and look at the Old Testament culture situation. Many of you who are older and you remember the good old days. I did a sermon some time ago in West Columbia entitled The Good Old Days. And I don't believe many people are going to look back at 2020 and say those were the good old days. There's a lot of reasons why. There was this pandemic you may have heard about, perhaps. All sorts of other things went on that most people look back at 2020 and say, good riddance forever. Glad that's in the rearview mirror. But some of you remember the good old days. Do you remember how that when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, the nation pulled together and we went to war to fight against a common foe? And there was a long period of time where the nation was united. We have those times like that periodically. Remember after 9/11, one of the most touching things that I can recall having seen in West Columbia is after 9/11, we had a period where nothing really happened. People were just sort of stunned. And then finally we got back to normal. Life started again. The very first football game at West Columbia in the high school ranks, the stadium was ringed by flags at the top of the stadium, and both teams ran out together, and instead of having their separate little pep rallies, they glammed together in one big group with flags in the middle, and it was real touching. But the most touching thing, they had a baseball game going at the Little League field next door. And when it came time for us to have the national anthem, I just happened to look over that direction. The flag was here and the Little League stadium was over here. Every one of those children stopped what they were doing, dropped their hats, and put their hands over their hearts, turned toward the flag at the football stadium. Now, their culture had been shattered and changed and built back really quickly into something that was probably better for them, because these kids were growing up at a time when lots of immoral things were being embraced and being accepted. So those good old days we can remember. It always seems to come after some tragedy for some reason, but we do have good days in the past. But what about today? How is culture affecting us? Some of you that were older, do you remember when you were little ever hearing anybody talk about gay marriage? Did that ever cross your grandparents' minds? Did you ever hear your parents consider the fact that maybe our grandson would rather be a granddaughter or something to that effect? You never heard things like that because it was just simply not part of the landscape. Now you probably, if you heard them talk, they knew there were folks that were homosexuals and so forth, but as a general rule, this was just not the culture. But now look where we are. We plan to take a little vacation next week, my family and I, and we had planned to go east, and we marked Disney right off the list, because Disney is not just having a gay pride day, they're having a great gay pride month. They're selling Mickey Mouse ear hats with their colors, and Disney Channel has an entire roster of shows devoted to pride. One of them is a cartoon short called Out. I read the little blurb about it. It says, a man is different than others, but his dog convinces him maybe he's got nothing to fear, so he can come out. Well, that's the Disney Channel. That used to be the channel of Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse and Goofy, and now it's how young people are being indoctrinated to embrace and accept something that the God of heaven calls vile passions. But here's the problem. You and I are students of the scriptures. We know what Paul said in Romans chapter 1. We know about the story of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. We know the story of Judges chapter 19 and all these events that show us that sin in its proper setting. But how long will it be until Christians, like many others today, hear of these things and say, what are you going to do about it? When that day comes, you'll see how powerful culture was in a negative way. One quick example of that. Do you all remember when Bill Clinton was caught having an affair with an intern? This was big news. It was every night there was a discussion about it. I happened to be at the local coffee shop one day. There's a group of older men that met and had coffee. And I remember this was clearly their discussion. They were talking about it. And one of the men, who was a lot older than me, plenty old enough to know better, said, you know what, I don't see what the big deal is. Half the men we know have adulterous relationships. This was the leader of the free world that was doing this, and he lied to Congress in the process of it, and this fellow said, well, it's just no big deal. Do we not see how culture affects us? How easy it is to wear off on us now? The story of Exodus is a story of a nation who, when they get to Mount Sinai, they receive the Ten Commandments. And these opening Ten Commandments, the first three or four, all deal with identifying God as who He is. But these are the same people that had been in slavery just recently. And they had been in slavery, according to the scriptures, in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 40, for 430 years. 70 people came with Jacob and settled in the land of Goshen, and then they grew into this giant nation that turned Pharaoh into a paranoid mess because he was afraid they were going to rise up and take over Egypt. Now Moses frees them from slavery, and they reach Mount Sinai, and after getting the law, what was the first thing that they did? They built a calf and worshiped it. What we're going to ponder today is, where did they learn about that calf worship business? They didn't get it from Jacob, I don't imagine. Do you think they got it from Joseph, who was second in command in Egypt? Had any of the patriarchs done it? Did they bring it with them? The answer to all of these is negative. But they were in a place where idols were worshipped for more than four centuries. You see, if our culture can whittle old men down to the point that they hear about a president of the United States committing adultery and say, what's the big deal? Then what can happen over four centuries of time to people that are supposed to worship one true God? That's the awful power of culture. And that's why the New Testament warns us to not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14. It's why it tells us over and over again to resist the devil and he'll flee for us. All right, let's turn to Exodus 20 now and read these commandments. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the God, the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself any carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. He rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Now those are the Ten Commandments, and they're very lengthy in the reading of them, but when you ponder these, I think they're all worthy of one lesson each, maybe two or three, some of them. We're not going to do that today because it seems self-evident what each one of the laws is all about. But when you analyze them, in light of this theme of culture, the emphasis is, I am God. I am the Lord. Now, earlier, when God commissioned Moses to go and release the children of Israel from slavery, he asked that question, who shall I say sent me? Well, he knew that he was going to have to introduce God to these people. They had lived for 4 centuries in slavery and amongst a people that were idolatrous and had a God for everything you could imagine. And the culture of the land may well have worn off on them, but more to the point, they were probably suspicious of Moses being raised in the house of Pharaoh and he killed the Egyptian. But what about this idea that he was going to have to tell these people, now understand who sent me. It's not Seth, the god of the Egyptians, not Ra, it's not Horus, it's not one of these other gods, but Jehovah, the one true God, the only God that there is. All that these Egyptians have worshipped are statues. But you worship the one true God. This is what your people have done all the way back before Abraham. Abraham was promised a land that we're going to go to. But this God has sent me to you. Well, it shouldn't surprise us that you read the first several. He says, I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall make no other carved images. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Why did he start here? Why not put 3 or 4 other commandments in the place of this? He was writing to Israel. Shouldn't this have all been obvious to them? Well, folks, if culture can affect our nation and our people after just a decade or two, imagine what this length of time may have done to these people who were Israel. You know, these people had been welcomed into the land of Goshen by the Pharaoh that loved Joseph. With open arms, he said, bring them all. And they came in the number of 70, settled in Goshen, the best part of the Nile Delta. They were given every advantage because this man loved Joseph. But over time, something changed. The nation began to grow. It got bigger, it got bigger, it got bigger. I'm not sure I'm qualified to say at what point things changed. But in the beginning, they were welcome guests in Egypt. And that's a pretty heady thing. You're welcomed into the land, you live at peace, and then finally another Pharaoh comes along somewhere down the row and he doesn't know Joseph. He remembers maybe the history he's been taught, but these people have gotten out of hand. We need to enslave them. Kill off their firstborn son so they quit having babies. We've got to do something. And so now they're enslaved, but again, they've been in Egypt a long time. You see these practices that are religious happening all around you. I've often wondered, way back at the start, when Jacob and his family back in chapter 45 through 47 of Genesis came to the land for the first time, what must they have thought when they saw a statue of one of these gods? Because even today, if you look at pictures of Egypt from the ancient times, there are statues of these gods everywhere. Not just that, but there are statues of some of the pharaohs that are still standing. The Sphinx was the head, I think, of Ramses. Ramses II was an interesting man because he was very full of himself, as rulers tend to be, but maybe pathologically so. He tore down the statues of a lot of his predecessors and had his own face put on them instead, just to make sure everybody knew he was the great king and God. They believed their king was a god living in the flesh. And so you still look at the artwork from Egypt, and you look at the statuary from the pictures, and you realize these people had a god for everything, and they even worshiped their king. What must Jacob have thought about this? Have you ever had an uh-oh moment in your life? A moment when you made a decision you felt like was great. You get there and you see what you've decided, and you think to yourself, uh-oh, what have I done? I always joke that my wife had that after we got married. It's just a joke, of course, but she and I have a pretty funny relationship. We laugh a lot. She's a sweet and wonderful woman, but I've often joked, after Perry got past the marriage and the courtship phase that came from it, we discovered our differences. You know, there are differences between men and women that never come to the fore until you live together as husband and wife. My beloved wife was just always and still is the sweetest, kindest, gentlest woman. She's always been so quiet. But one of the things we discovered is she was not a morning person. And I was. I would wake up in the morning singing Sousa music. And she would just kind of grumble around the house. And I'd try to jostle her into wakefulness. And it just never seemed to work. She just got more and more aggravated. Well, this quiet, gentle woman who, when we were dating, could not hardly speak for fear of just saying something that embarrassed her. After being married several weeks, she was brushing her hair in the bathroom. And I was shaving and whistling some tune and making little jokes. At one point, I reached over and poked her in the ribs, and air whizzed past my face. The hairbrush shattered against the wall. And she said, "I have had enough." Well, here was a woman that had been pushed past her breaking point by the culture she had entered. And I've always wondered if that wasn't the moment she thought, "What did I do?" Well, she's weathered it okay. We've been married a long, long time. And she's really toughened up quite a lot. She has a sense of humor now. And she's more of a morning person than she ever used to be. But the culture you enter does change you. I've learned to not sing Sousa tunes until at least noon. That's how my marriage culture has altered me. And she's learned to more roll with the punches than she used to. But you see, after a long period of time, have you noticed how some married couples look the same, talk the same, walk the same, have the same gestures? It's two different people came from different parts of the world and different backgrounds. And after a number of years of marriage, it's almost like you think they're brother and sister. They look so much alike. They talk alike. They just adopt each other's characteristics. That's culture. Those things are harmless, and in fact, they're even good. I needed my wife to settle me down, if you will. And she needed somebody to bring her out of her shell. Well, we provided both of that for one another. And marriage is good that way. Children come into that family environment. They learn how to adapt to things they may or may not like, and they're better people for it. But it's the culture outside of that house that worries me to death. It's that culture that's out in the world that they must confront and learn how to cope with that scares me to no end. You know, I'd like you to think about this. Over in my New Testament, I had it here with me a few minutes ago. I don't know what became of it. It's in Zeke's office, I'm sure. I'd like you to look over at Romans chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. For just a second, the passage we referred to just a little while ago, Romans chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. Of course, this whole chapter is dealing with the sin of the Romans, and he talks about how that they did not retain God in their knowledge, and everything that they did went from bad to worse. They ended up being in every way antisocial. But verses 26 and 27 says, "For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. For even their women exchange the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another. Men with men committing what is shameful, and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which is due. Now, Paul calls this sin of homosexuality vile passions. And the culture problem is what worries me here. And the incidents we see in Israel during their time of enslavement, after and throughout their history, is what, to me, tells us what's coming. My daughter, Sarah, has been raised in a home where she's been taught about God since the first day of her birth. I did something with her that I also did with my oldest child. When we brought them home from the hospital, I took them outside. And even though they were brand new babies, newborns, they didn't understand anything I was saying, I took them outside so they could hear the birds chirping. And they could feel the warmth on their face and feel the breeze on their face. And I said to this little infant, Sarah, I said, "Honey, God made those birds. God made the breeze. God made the sunshine." And of course, all she did is just look around and react to little sounds that she heard. Literally from the moment of her birth into this world, she's heard about God. And that's all she's ever been taught. She's been taught his laws. She's been taught to love him. She's been taught to respect his authority. She's been taught to become a Christian. She has become a Christian. She's lived for years as a Christian. She's learned how to resist the temptation of the devil, but the world is still out there. The world is still out there pulling on her. And I constantly remind her of this. She came home to me one day, her sophomore year in high school, and she is pretty upset, and I asked what the problem was, and she said, "Dad, there are two girls at school that are walking around holding hands." And I said, "Does the school not have a hands-off policy? We used to have that in Texas City when I was growing up." She said, "I don't know if that's exactly what exists, but they're not supposed to." I said, "Okay." I said, "But what about that really bothers you?" She said, "Dad, girls aren't supposed to be holding hands like they're in love." I said, "You're right." She said, "But they're not the only ones." And she listed about five or six other little groups of girls that's what they do. And she said, "Dad, what all of a sudden is this that we have these people everywhere? Everywhere you look, there's more and more and more." I said, "Honey, don't be misled. That is not true. There are not more homosexuals and lesbians than in the world today than there ever has been. I don't believe that for a minute. But here's what we have is different. All of you ladies remember a time when girls would get together and have sleepovers and braid each other's hair? Do you remember how girls have always painted each other's toenails and so forth, and everybody thought, well, those are just two good friends. And now two girls get together and do things like that, and someone will say, y'all are a really cute couple." And so the girls who are young and inexperienced, and believe me, young girls have strong feelings toward one another, a friendship. And so they think, well, maybe we are a couple. It's not that they have this sexual inclination. It's that the world is now pushing them actively down that road. And they see it everywhere they look, in the media, on the Disney Channel. They see it in the actors and actresses. Today, we got news that an NFL player, the very first one in NFL history, has come out as openly gay. And the news guys I was listening to in traffic said, it's great. Older gentleman, 25, 30, 40 years ago, would that have been the news that you got? No, sir, you wouldn't have. It wasn't because there were just a bunch of people back then that hated folks. No. It's that back then people recognized the law of God and they understood and respected his authority and recognized that this is a sin. But now we live in a culture where if you say that, you're going to get canceled. You say that, you're going to be shut down. And so now all around our young people, they're being pushed, dragged, pulled, influenced down that road. There is an actor, a comedian who once said, she would be disappointed if at least one of her kids was not transgender. Now, she's a comedian. Maybe I'll give her the benefit of the doubt. She was making a joke. I don't know that she was, but that certainly reflects the thinking of many people. You see, inside my house, I can protect my daughter. Inside the home, I can tell her what is right and wrong, and I can lead her in that way. But I'm not with my daughter 24/7. I just simply can't be. That's not the way God wants us to raise our kids. They're supposed to learn how to live in this world. So at some point, they're going to have to be in contact with it. And when that day happens, that culture of today is going to try its best to destroy them. When the Bible says the devil is a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour, think about what a lion does. A lion does not just simply wait opportunistically for an animal to come over and lie down in front of its jaws. A lion is constantly on the predator hunt, always creeping about, always stalking in the tall savanna grass, looking for the greatest opportunity. There may be an entire flock or herd or whatever they call a bunch of wildebeests drinking at a little pond in Africa. The lion doesn't just roar up on them and just hope he can catch one. What he does is sneak and sneak down away from the wind direction until he gets close enough to pick out the weakest and the most unstable, and then he pounces when there's no more opportunity to flee. That's what the devil wants to do. He wants to stalk and attack and destroy. You know, when Peter describes false teachers in 2 Peter chapter 2, he said the ones they prey upon are the unsteadfast in verse 14. There are Christians that are unsteadfast. They're unstable. They don't study like they ought to. They don't prepare their mind and their heart. And that's who the devil has an easy time with. They're the ones that are going to easily be prey for anything that's contrary to the truth. Well, folks, here was a group of people that traveled into this land under the auspices of peace. Go back to the book of Genesis a little bit. Let's see a little bit of the history and notice how innocuously it all started. Back in Genesis chapter 41, we won't look at all the history of Joseph, which, by the way, he is such a hero. One of the most wonderful examples in all the Bible of a young man that did everything right and nothing but bad came his way until he was elevated to the position God wanted him as second in command in Egypt. But he interpreted the dream of Pharaoh. And we pick up the reading in Genesis 41 and verse 33. The Bible says, "Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land to collect 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years, and let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming, and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, and the land may not perish during the famine." So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, shall be over all, and my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and he clothed him in his garments in fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had. And they cried out before him, "Bow the knee." So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, "I am sending Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or his foot in all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him his wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. And Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh as king in Egypt. What a story. You know, he had been in the household of Potiphar. He had been in a prison. He had been thrown into a pit by his own brothers and presumably left to die. They all wanted to kill him until one spoke up in his defense. He had really been through the mill for no other reason than that his father loved him specially and he received these dreams about his own greatness. But in time, all of it came out to be true. He was indeed elevated. And the story continues in chapter 42 with Joseph's brothers coming and kneeling before him just like he had dreamed. And as time wore on, Joseph sort of played a cat and mouse game with them until he finally couldn't stand it anymore and he revealed himself to his brothers. And as they wept in fear, he told them to not be afraid. This was all God's design. He had forgiven them and now he loved his brothers. He welcomed them back and he introduced the whole issue to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said, bring your family here. Turn over with me to chapter 45 of Genesis. Genesis chapter 45. And let's read, if you would, verses 16 through 18. Now the report of it was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, Joseph's brothers have come. So it pleased Pharaoh and his servants well. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your beast and depart, go to the land of Canaan. Bring your father and your households and come to me. I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat of the fat of the land. Now you are commanded, do this, take carts out of the land of Egypt for your little ones and your wives, and bring your father and come. And do not be concerned about your goods, for the best of the land of Egypt is yours. Then the sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them carts according to the commandment of Pharaoh. And he gave them provisions for the journey. He gave all of them, each man, changes of garments. But to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of garments. And he sent to his father these things, 10 donkeys loaded with the good things of Egypt, 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread and food for his father and for the journey. So he sent his brothers away and they departed. He said unto them, see that you do not become troubled along the way. Then they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to Jacob their father and told him these things. Well, Jacob then takes his journey in chapter 46 and comes into the land and he greets Pharaoh and Pharaoh treats him respectfully as the patriarch of Joseph's family. And Jacob does not bow before Pharaoh and do obeisance to him, but he shows him proper respect. There is a mutual admiration that clearly existed between Pharaoh and Jacob because Jacob raised Joseph. You know, when I think about the story of Potiphar's wife, Potiphar's wife put the moves on a young man that many young men would not have resisted. Many young men would have acceded to her demands gladly. But Joseph cited the fact that Potiphar had made him basically lord of the house, and he could not in any way violate that master's trust. But he said more than that, I cannot sin against God. And she grasped onto him, attempting to force him. And he left with incriminating evidence in her hand that she would use against him. When I think about that story, I ask myself, what was it different about Joseph? What was it about him that enabled him to have such power? Whereas other young men throughout every generation would have just dived right into the sin. I don't know when it happened, where it happened. We're not privy to the story. But somewhere his father told him, fornication is a sin. He was taught that. He knew it would have been a sin for him to engage in this. That's how Joseph was able to resist. Now, if you want to talk about culture, hey, the Egyptians were immoral people. They worshiped false gods. This was a woman who was extremely immoral. She was willing to forsake her marriage vow to her husband and engage in this act with this young man. And she was very aggressive about it. This young man was able to resist culture because his parents had taught him right from wrong. His dad had somewhere along the line taught him that you obey God, you follow God, you keep His law, and you do not violate this commandment. You do not violate the marriage vow of another man and take his wife in adultery. You just don't do it, even if she throws herself at you. You know, Jacob never saw this coming, I'm sure. I doubt his father ever thought, you know, Joseph, someday in the future, there's going to be a rich woman throw herself at you. He didn't have to know that to know that's part of the world we live in. You see, Joseph was of an excellent spirit, and he was raised up to this position by God's providence, yes, but also, how could Pharaoh not have seen the good in him? How could Pharaoh not have taken this fellow that came up with the perfect plan and then treat his family this way? So Jacob and his family are now welcomed into Egypt, and they were treated kindly. They were treated with deference. They were given all sorts of things. But now that brings us back to the book of Exodus again. And this time, chapter 32. A lot of history has passed. You notice we have skipped over the plagues and we've skipped over the Exodus. That you've covered it either earlier or will later in the week. But today, we're just talking about the culture of Egypt and how it weighed on these people. In chapter 32, when Moses had gone into the mountain to commune with God and was there for longer than the people thought necessary, they were concerned unduly. Verse 1 says, "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said unto him, 'Come and make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.' And Aaron said unto them, 'Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me.' So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a golden calf. Then they said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.' So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow is the feast day to the Lord.' Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play." Now, look at the scene and how sorry this was. These were people that just recently had been slaves in Egypt. The days of the good times were past. The heady days when they were welcomed peaceably were long gone. However long it took them to be enslaved, you know, Joseph lived 100 and some odd years and Levi 137. That whole generation died off before the slavery ever began. Let's just round it and say that for 200 years in Egypt, the children of Israel had a fairly peaceful existence. And somewhere along the way, the new Pharaoh came along and enslaved them. At some point, it became severe bondage. They had to make bricks without straw. They had to gather all their materials. They were whipped and they were beaten and mistreated in every way, as slaves typically were. So they cried out to God, and God sent Moses. The plagues were enacted, and the people of Israel were safely carried across the Red Sea. They walked on dry ground. Paul says they were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They were no longer slaves of Pharaoh. They were slaves of God. Now here they are at the base of Mount Sinai, receiving the Ten Commandments before proceeding directly to Canaan. Tonight we're going to talk about the 12 spies. You know, they didn't wander in the wilderness right away. That came after they rejected the land God gave them. They marched in a beeline for the land, and once they got there, they couldn't bring themselves to enter for fear. But here at Mount Sinai, when Moses was away from them a little longer than they were comfortable with, their first reaction was to build a calf and worship it. Aaron, the mouthpiece of Moses, remember who he was? He was Moses' mouthpiece to Pharaoh. Moses was afraid that he was of such a slow tongue, he couldn't possibly speak in any intelligible way to the Pharaoh. So God said, "Here comes your brother Aaron, I'll make him your mouthpiece." And Aaron was the one that cast his staff down and made it into a serpent. 10 minutes? Okay. He was able to performed these various miracles through Aaron, and who was it that immediately, with the provocation of the people, said, well, I've got a solution here. Bring me all your gold, and he molded a calf. Now, we're down on time, so let's just summarize what he told Moses. Moses came down from the mountain and said, Aaron, what have you done? He said, oh, I don't know. They brought me the gold, threw it in the fire, and out came this calf. Liar. That's not what happened. You told them bring the gold, and you molded a calf. What they would do is they would make a wooden structure, and they would beat gold into a real thin film, and they would mold it around this idol, and that took a lot of work. Where did they learn all that? It has to be Egypt. I can't imagine it was Jacob. I read a comment about this, some commentator who said, well, the Canaanites worship cows. Well, that means Jacob must have brought it with him. But we know that's not true, because when Jacob brought his family to the land of Egypt, one of the first things he did is stop in Beersheba and worship God. He built an altar to God in Beersheba. See, he didn't build one to a cow. He built one to God. But you see, 430 years in slavery, not only will that warp your view of things, if all the people around you are treating you kindly and they worship idols, and all you've seen, and remember, these are not the people that came to Canaan, they're their descendants many generations later. They were born, many of them had died, and now this generation was born in this culture. It doesn't take too much figuring to see where they got this idea. Now, these are the people of God. These are the ones that are the descendants of Abraham, whom God is going to give the land of promise. Now, since we're short on time, let me ask you to remember ahead. What is one of the main warnings that God gave his people from this time forward, all the way through even the period of the minor prophets, to Malachi, the last who wrote anything in the Old Testament? You remember, don't you? It's, quit worshiping idols. Why have you not torn down the high places? Why do you still go up to the high places and worship the idols? Why do you worship Baal? Why do you worship Ashtaroth? Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and they turned his heart away from God. Jeroboam the first king of the northern kingdom, in order to keep his people loyal to him and not go back to Jerusalem, he built a calf in Dan and Beersheba, both ends of the nation. That way the people would have a God they could worship without going to the temple. Where did this all come from? You see how strongly the culture of Egypt was in the hearts of the people. I want you to look at one other passage real quickly. Deuteronomy chapter 7. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 3 and 4, the Bible says, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. Why did God place this prohibition on them? It wasn't because he thought Canaanite women were unattractive or their men were ugly. It was because they would become idolaters. He had seen it already. The first chance they have to stand for God after leaving Egypt, you remember the complaints they had? It was even before the calf incident. They crossed over the Red Sea and began to complain. Well, where's the food? Where's the water? We were better off back in Egypt. At least there we had onions and leeks and pots of meat to the full. They were so influenced by that culture of Egypt that it's all they could think about. And now Deuteronomy 7 tells these people, you can't marry among the Canaanites or you'll do the same thing. You'll marry them and you'll start serving their gods because you've proven this weakness that you have. And the culture that's around you, you let it get too close to you. Now let me finish with this. What can we do? Our day is filled with sin. Ungodliness of every kind. Idolatry has its examples. People make idols of their money and their houses and their possessions and so forth. But we have these immoral things that are accepted as normal and even being promoted as good among people. What can we do to help our children, and help ourselves resist the culture of today. In Deuteronomy 6, I think we have our answer. If Israel had done this, they would have been able to thwart every culture that opposed God. In verse 6 it says, "And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart." If we study the Word of God and we treasure it within our hearts and we are determined to live by it, we're going to resist all that's opposed to it. "You shall teach them diligently to your children, shall talk of them when you sit in the house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up." If you want to spare your children the culture's influence, talk about God morning, noon, and night. Don't just talk about Him, mean it. Teach them the meaning of the Scripture, how it applies, and show it in your life that this is your conviction. You think about God, you treasure God in your heart, and your law, the children need to grow up seeing you worship God. Have any of you ever known of brethren that come to worship, hear a sermon on God's Word, and go home and their children hear a diet of roast preacher and roast elder? These crazy people we worship, how are they ever going to grow up wanting to be Christians if that's what they hear and what they see? They should see in our teaching, in our lives, that we love God as much as we're telling them to love God. Verse 8 says, "You shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be as frontlets between your eyes." He was talking about the phylacteries. They would put Scripture on their forehead and on their arms, and it was symbolically meant to keep the Scripture close to their hearts. "You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." I have a hobby. I do two things. I play a trumpet and I do calligraphy. And calligraphy came from this verse. I take pen and paper and I write out Scriptures and kind of fancy lettering and frame them and give them away widely. Because I want people to do that. Put this on your house. Zeke has one on his office, I think. And the Scriptures are how we inoculate ourselves and our children. But it must be conviction. And I think it's what Deuteronomy 6 is teaching us, conviction. Folks, the culture of the world is against us. The culture of Egypt destroyed Israel because they let it happen. That's the problem. I appreciate your attention. I think we're finished.